Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are broadcasting today from the University of California, Irvine. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have on New York literary agent John Ware. Prior to opening his agency, John Ware served as a literary agent with James Brown Associates, Curtis Brown Limited, and as an editor for Doubleday and Company. While working as an editor, he taught the industry-wide editorial workshop in the publishing program at NYU. He has a degree in philosophy from Cornell. His agency represents a variety of nonfiction and fiction. Clients include Jon Krakauer, Jennifer Niven, and Travis Hugh Culley. Hi, John.
Hey, Barbara.
Great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
It's always wonderful to talk to you. For those listeners, and I'm assuming there are a lot of them, who didn't hear the show when you were on a few years ago, will you talk a little bit about what made you become an agent? What drew you to that part of the publishing business where you've stayed for quite a while?
Well, that's really a matter of logistics. I was extremely happy as an editor, and the positions are really similar because both an editor and a literary agent read something and decide what they want to do with it. And indeed, at the end of that process, as you and probably your audience may know, the editor and the literary agent then negotiate with each other at the end of the reading process about what's going to become of that project. So the work is similar. This evaluative process of the manuscript, which is the essence of it, is similar. But I found after a time that I preferred freedom from, frankly, the responsibilities to many other aspects of the editor's job outside of editorial. That is, the editor is really the hub of the wheel. And beyond being the author's advocate inside a publishing house, the editor is concerned with every department in that house because they all contribute to the making of a book, whether it's the art department, production department, design, the sales department, all aspects of marketing, as well as the more parochial editorial functions. And I guess I wanted, as time went by, to just concentrate my efforts on the editorial function, which is the only function I have as a literary agent other than the business of placing a book and negotiating a contract. That is to say, except as advisor, I don't have those responsibilities to design, production, art department, marketing, and all the meetings thereof. I kind of wanted to get away from all of the meetings of those departments. So it seemed to me a simpler life with the same basic task at the forefront. And I had a lovely offer to take that position. And I think the other thing, to answer your question, is I decided I liked the smaller size. I mean, any literary agency is small compared to a publisher. So Doubleday was about 400 people, and I was extremely happy there. I turned down many jobs to stay there in editorial. I was so happy. But in the end, there was a tremendous appeal to a three- or four-person shop after the years of 300 and 400 people.
Mm-hmm.
So simple logistical answers, really.
Sure. In talking with you before on the radio and meeting you in New York and having written communication with you, you strike me as a writer. And I have no idea if you write yourself or what. I would think that regardless of that, that your clients probably receive a lot of hands-on work and involvement from you. Is that so? Do you get real involved with
manuscripts? My academic background, as you mentioned, is in linguistic philosophy. And unbeknownst to me at the time, although I originally had an academic goal of going on to teach that, with publishing as a plan B eventuated, and I was so well served to be an editor from all of that work with the precision involved in doing linguistic philosophy. As I say, unbeknownst to me, it was great career preparation for publishing. And you know, to answer your other question, I'm a little bit of a frustrated poet. I never wrote prose, but I've written poetry and actually came close once at the New Yorker with a poem about an aging pitcher. But never prose. And frankly, very difficult for me, and I've decided this is not a cop-out, very difficult for me in the last number of years to go on with my poetry efforts because I don't court editorial work with my clients, but I'll say unhumbly, I do it well from my editorial years.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in the spirit of hands-on, as you said, I'm so involved with the words of other people, I am not refreshed to turn to my own.
Hmm.
And so I have sung in a choir, I have studied Italian, I have done other creative things, but I cannot seem in any sustained way to write poetry anymore. Whether it's there's no busman's holiday there or whatever it is, I think as much as I love words, I do get used up. And I need to go to a concert or a ball game or, you know, do something different.
Sure. So what knocks you out when it comes in the door?
What knocks me out, I think, is two things. In terms of content, it's something that I consider to be, at least in my heart, in my gut, something substantive enough that I can consider big game. Something that makes a contribution. I really don't, I guess it's the only area of life where I'm a bit of a snob. I really don't do, I don't know, given the geography here, you have to forgive this phrasing, but Hollywood sex and violence,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. I do pretty literate fiction and nonfiction that, whether it explores an unknown odd corner such as Travis Culley's memoir of being a Chicago bike messenger,
sure.
or John Krakauer's look at the Mormon faith in this current happy bestseller, something that makes a contribution to worldly knowledge and maybe even, you know, of social value as well.
So more nonfiction?
That's one. And the other thing is care with language,
mm-hmm.
good writing,
mm-hmm.
careful writing. People who care about being precise and economical in the way they write.
Sure. So more nonfiction than fiction?
More nonfiction, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely do fiction, and I will continue to. I do have some valued colleagues, editor friends, who, for various reasons, one of whom described his reason to me as simple heartbreak, have, much to my shock, given up fiction and just finding it too tough to do, heartbreaking to do, a chancier marketplace and so forth. But I simply cannot do that. I had a first novel published this spring, which I can say a little about, and I like to try for that every year because even as a private reader, I'm a heavy news follower, but in my day, every day, even as a private reader, let alone work, I need both fiction and nonfiction in my life. I just can't go too far with either one.
So, but
more nonfiction, yes.
So yeah. I'm so curious about this because I've heard from friends who are trying to market fiction that they're having just the toughest time finding an agent. And it seems that, I mean, with fiction, it's become tougher and tougher for writers to find agents and then I suppose for agents to sell it. And yet it's selling. I mean, people are reading fiction. So what's the problem? What's going on?
Well, it is more difficult. I think the hoops are higher because you're right, happily, that the public is reading some good fiction, and you can see that in bookstores and in book reviews and so forth. But overall, I'm not sure that the quantity of those readers and therefore that the quantity of those books is what it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I'm not sure it's going up. I'd like to believe it is. I'd like to completely agree with your leaning that it is, but I'm not sure of that. In any case, it seems to me that the number of slots for literate fiction are just plain down at the publishing houses, and so the hoops are just higher than ever. And a novel essentially has to be, in effect, indispensable to an editor. He or she has got to have it to go on with their life. It really becomes that strong. And it's almost that way for me, and not just because of going through those hoops, but in order to do the effort, as an editor recently wrote me in a in a very sad rejection letter of one of my fiction clients, in order to live with the two-year Sisyphean task of editing fiction, I need that bedrock passion. And in this case, she didn't happen to have it. And I knew what she meant. Sometimes you read a piece of fiction and you say, you know, that's perfectly fine. Indeed, it's accomplished. The writer can really turn a phrase. But then you just have to reach down inside, really your human side. It doesn't have anything to do, at least in me, with marketing thoughts. You just look at it and wonder. And sometimes, by the way, I do with nonfiction too. If I'm on the fence, I leave something literally on my desk after I've read it and walk around it for a week and just look at it to prompt my thoughts. Then it's a matter of reaching deep down inside you as a person and saying, okay, do I kind of like this, or would I go to the mat for this? Am I insane about this book?
Mm-hmm.
And I require the latter of myself.
Yes.
And I think that's why I love my work so much, because I work on things that I would go to the mat for, that I'm passionate about.
I've heard agents say that they'll handle a lot of nonfiction, self-help, how-to, all kinds of nonfiction, and at the same time, they love, say, literary fiction, and it's the nonfiction that supports the quirky novel or the literary novel that may not get much money and may be a difficult sell. Would you comment on that? Is that something you would do?
I think that that's true at publishing houses. It certainly has been true historically with poetry, for example, for those publishers who still, and there are a few, still publish poetry. If it weren't for the support of some of the other staples, that really is an indulgence, the publishing of poetry per se. I can remember, by the way, on that score, when I was an editor at Doubleday, there came a point when Robert Graves, at age, 88 or something, came into the black on his modest poetry advances and sales over the years because of the number of selections writers had chosen as epigraphs.
Oh.
He went into the black at the age of 88.
Oh, dear.
And it was a big celebration.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think about, as for my own list, I don't think of it that way. I suppose I could, because I think if I laid out the income from my books, I think, in fact, the nonfiction probably pays the freight and pulls the major weight, you know?
Yes.
But as I said, it isn't so much that for me. I need that balance as in terms of my literary hungers. But in fact, yeah, it's true. It's probably just as true on my list and other agents' lists as publishers' lists, that unless you represent someone like John Grisham or Stephen King or, a really big fiction star, I think it is fair to say that for most agencies, as with publishers, the nonfiction pays for the utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And even if the fiction's not like poetry as an indulgence, unless it's one of the big stars of the fiction list, it probably makes less income.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. Today my guest is New York literary agent John Ware. How do most of your clients find you? You're in the reference books. You're in literary
directories
agents and here and
some
there.
Some of those directories, not all, but some of them, leave room. Literary Marketplace is one, sort of our phone book, LMP, leave room for us to list our interests. And those are the most constructive directories, because writers can really not just see our names and phone and fax and so forth, they can see our list of interests. And I think LMP, and if not some of the others, also invite us to mention some of the books we've placed in the previous year. So they can really see what it is we've been doing quite specifically and if we would be a match for them. That is one place that writers find us. Writers are also, for the most part, quite kind in acknowledging their literary agents and their editors. So I know that some people come to me from generous acknowledgments of my clients. Some of them come from speaking engagements such as the ones, you know, I've been involved in with you, Barbara, at ASJA or other venues. I go to probably about two or three a year. I've been all across the country at conferences, and I don't think that I can count up a large number of projects that have come to fruition all the way to publication from all of those conferences. But I certainly have some, and you never know. You meet someone at a conference in Dallas, and 6 years later, you get a letter from their cousin who says, you know, my cousin, you know, really enjoyed hearing you back in 97 at that conference you went to.
Yes.
And so, you know, you never know. Writers travel in many circles, and there's lots of cross-pollination, and so I never say no. I never say no to a writer's conference. I love talking to writers anyway.
Well, and speaking of which, you're going to be at ASJ's conference next April, the 25th, 2004, in New York. So I'll talk more about that at the end. But
let me see what else. And then, of course, there are referrals from, apart from reading acknowledged, there are referrals from clients, referrals from writer friends who are not clients, and coming out of, the conferences. I guess that's about it. I guess that's the sources. You know, we're sort of old school, ladies and gentlemen, in that unlike even lawyers and doctors now, we do not advertise anywhere. So the only printed form are these directory listings. And I guess the other source is just the mail. And once or twice a year, I absolutely find something wonderful in the mail over the transom.
So you read your mail?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And when I was with James Brown Associates, Curtis Brown, there was a definite hierarchy in getting to that mail. I was the low man on the totem pole when I began, so James Brown himself would read it first, and then the second agent who'd been there, and then me. So the mail is very important, because there are people, I have clients, whether it's someone like Travis Cully, the Chicago bike messenger I mentioned, up to professionals, a world-class paleontologist, for example, people who may be quite eminent in their worlds, but they have absolutely no connection with the book publishing industry, so they're left to sit down and write a cold query as much as any, you know, non-degreed person from around the country. So you can open your mail and find a letter from an astonishingly senior scientist, let's say, because they have no tie with trade publishing. So they're left to write a query letter with a stamped self-addressed envelope, just like a bike messenger.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about queries. And we talked about this the last time you were on the show, but how does a writer's style translate in what is essentially a business letter, a one-page letter from a writer trying to sell you on the idea of their book?
Well, I think if a writer is just straightforward, I think his or her inimitable style, hopefully for the best, leaks. I mean, yes, there are some who can get so mechanistic they end up writing a terrible business letter that seems like it's coming from an MBA about a job. But most of them don't step on their own feet to that degree. If they just sit down and keep it simple and economical, you'd be surprised how much their style gets through in this format, even though it is not the book itself. Even with a fiction writer, it's surprising. It's surprising even to them. I'm thinking of one client who is a Tucson writer named Nancy Turner, who wrote me probably the best query letter I ever received. And she was shocked that her writing style could get through this letter, the style that indeed is in her books, could come through so well in this matter-of-fact letter of application to a literary agent. But I think it just does, Barbara. I think people's style is what it is. Don't you think? And it leaks a little bit.
Sure.
In spite of your maybe attempt to be businessy or whatever. And it's a good thing.
So what was it about Nancy Turner's letter that leaked through? What made it the best letter?
Well, who can be super analytical about what makes for good writing?
Sure.
I don't know the precise answer, but there was just something that made me want to keep reading, as was the case with her first novel. I just thought, this is a stylist. She may not even be trying to be in this letter, but she clearly is one, and she has kept me interested in reading from line to line to line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just came out of her. I think she was trying to be very serious and businesslike and not stylish. But there it was, because that's the way she writes.
That's it.
Happily.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody. For most everybody. I think it's pretty hard, unless a writer is really trying to be too refined. It's hard for a writer to step on their own toes so much that their own honest style doesn't come through in that letter. You'd be surprised how much. I mean, I'm surprised how much, but it's true.
Okay, a real mundane question here.
Yeah.
So what happens to queries if you don't get a self-addressed stamped envelope? Do they get tossed, or will you
put your own stamp on there? That I'm sure that's hard for a writer to understand, but if writers could understand the volume of mail that we get, that that helps so much, not just the defraying of the postage, yes, the 37 cents, but even the making out of the envelope.
Right.
Saves my assistant an inordinate time. And I think it's just a built-in courtesy that fortunately has survived.
Now, will you first see if there's an envelope, whether to either read it or not, or will you read it and then go, oh, you know, I'm just going to throw it out because it's no good, I'm not interested?
I will read it no matter what. But, you know, honestly, it's so rare that writers don't observe the courtesy.
Mm-hmm.
Very rare. Most writers do. Either that or they don't do so knowingly. They say, you know, I'm not including an S-A-S-E. If you're interested, let me know. If you're not, you can just, you know.
Right. And that's fine?
And that's fine, sure.
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 What about gimmicks, queries, and pizza boxes?
Nah. not a good thing. Not a good thing. A simple one-page letter and a stamped self-addressed envelope. Now, I must say that there are some agents would disagree with me and want a chapter or three chapters. For me, I guess I'm just busy enough that I always feel as though samples of text I can ask for.
Mm-hmm.
So I really put in all the directories, just a one-page letter, please, and let me decide from the letter if I want to follow it up with a sample.
Sure. I know a few fiction writers who will include, say, the first page or two from their novel along with their query.
A page or two is fine.
Yeah, it's when you're deluged with material.
It's when you get a chapter or more.
Sure.
I think a page or two is just fine.
Hmm.
Sure.
Hmm. Just a little bit more on literary fiction before we take a break. What is it about literary fiction that you like? Is it the language? Is it the characters? Is it the plot? Is it all of that?
I think it's the first two things you said more than the plot. I think literary fiction can have plots as moving, driving, and overall as respectable as, quote, commercial fiction. But for me, what separates it out in terms of the label is that literary fiction seems to be written more carefully, for one thing. It can have an equally driving pace, but written more carefully. And the characters seem to me much more real people. And that's the intent of the writer. Whereas I think sometimes in commercial fiction, quote-unquote, always on those labels, but sometimes in that genre, the characters can be a little bit in the service of the plot, the plot, the plot. And I'm just, here we get into subjectivity.
Sure.
I'm just the person who enjoys characterization and enjoys character-driven fiction. So I think it is, for me, if I had to make it concrete, I would say it's the language and the characterization that separate it out.
Sure. Well, we're going to take a short break. All of you out there in Radio Land, stay with us. We'll be back with John Ware in just a few minutes. Please don't go away. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org. And I do hope we are on the web today. We've been having a bit of server difficulties, and seems that it's straightened out. So all of you out there who've tried to listen the last few weeks, hopefully you're there and picking up this program. I also want to say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not the University of California Regents. Hi, John.
Hi, Barbara. Can I put a plug in here for
a client
of mine who is a University of California Irvine MFA graduate?
Definitely.
That's so interesting that you're... So it's appropriate, right?
Yes, it's appropriate.
This is a writer named Elise Blackwell, whose first novel, Hunger, was published by Little Brown this spring.
Huh.
A marvelous, lean, little 100 and, I have it in my hands, 132-page tour de force, love story of love and survival set against the siege of Leningrad, and involving a botanist trying to survive and at the same time save the precious seeds from the lab, with all the temptation during the starvation of the siege. Of the siege to eat them.
Interesting.
And many other aspects to it.
I should have her on my show.
Hunger.
Yeah.
She, Elise, is now teaching herself at Boise State.
Interesting.
Up in Idaho.
All right.
But had to put the plug in since she's of the community where you're broadcasting.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, you know, that actually raises a question. 132-page novel. Now, a lot of fiction writers go for heft, I think, more than not. And someone might say, oh, you know, I have to hit at least, oh, I don't know, 200-some pages, 250, or else they'll, you know, look at me cross-eyed, they'll throw out my letters.
And fair enough, and fair enough. I would say that the standard is roughly 60,000 words, maybe somewhere between 50 and 60. And manuscript count of about 200. When Elise sent this to me, I was not successful in placing, came close, but could not quite place her first kind of modern feminist woman's novel some years ago. When she sent it to me, Little Brown actually bulked it up. It was 109 manuscript pages, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant, but I said to her at the time, Elise, for categorical reasons of brevity, I don't think I can place this. I'll make some phone calls. And in fact, I found every house but one. I'll leave that house out as a matter of courtesy. Every house but one said, oh, fine, well, if it's brilliant, that's fine. We'd make an exception. But I don't think you're incorrect to cite the general rule of this is very rare.
Hmm.
I think 50,000 to 60,000, and I've always said 60, as a guide to the minimum. Absolutely good, fair to say. This was a highly unusual case.
I personally kind of like shorter novels than longer novels, maybe because there's so much reading I do for the show and still want some reading time left over that, I don't know, I like shorter works.
Well, it's funny, everybody's different. A client of mine just submitted her new novel to me, and we happened to be talking yesterday, and he knows about her, and she told me how much she just finished East of Eden. And was on to some other long books and told me that, although this is not what she's written herself, she loves a 600, 700-page novel.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, you know, everybody's different.
Sure. So what about short story collections?
Very difficult. Very different standard from the first novel. The only way, again, there are always exceptions, but I must say I've never succeeded with an exception to the following, and that is that unlike the first novelist, the short story writer with a collection really has to have major credits for, I would say, somewhere near, what, a third to half of the stories. Maybe not the New Yorker, but it can't be, you know, unknown literary quarterlies from... you know, northern Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
There have to be some credits on, I would say half would be a good guide of the stories. With the first novel, you need no credits.
Yeah.
It's odd, but I think the format is, I guess in the view of the marketing people, is difficult enough. So if you're going to get people to pick up a collection, there need to be some brand names showing. And those brand names are the magazines and literary quarterlies where the writer's been published, in brief.
So I suppose a way that fiction and nonfiction differ in terms of the writer and the writer's, say, resume is that nonfiction writers, authors need more of presence, platform, what have you, whereas fiction writers, really it's the work.
Well, yeah, I think that as a general comparison is fair, although I have to say I think some nonfiction writers don't need a platform. I think we're an increasingly common word, by the way, in the publishing business, and it is, I guess, quite literal, some basis from which to speak publicly about your work and not just put it between covers. The promoting, reference to the promoting that any nonfiction writer does much, much, much more than a fiction writer. I mean, in fact, it's classic lore that the finest, most interesting fiction writers are not welcome guests on many shows because hosts and staff always seem to think that novelists can only talk about their novels, that they're not broader people, that they can't discuss the world, whereas nonfiction writers are with topics of the world and are more worldly and can be better guests. But the fact is, with nonfiction, I think that some of the more functional books require a platform, a speaking platform, than others. Certainly, let's say psychiatrists writing about a topic need to have the bona fides and probably need to have spoken, and that's probably true of, you know, nutritionists. And I think people in that area, maybe Barbara, in the writing area, where you do some work, maybe there has to be credits and speaking background. But there are many areas of nonfiction. I mean, for example, my client John Krakauer. John, in fact, does speak and has just finished his tour, Front of the Banner of Heaven, Hating Every Minute, although he does it most ably. But John never, for that or his previous books, you know, bestsellers, Into the Wild and Into Thin Air, he and many other nonfiction writers with major sales out of the more functional book never had, I think, what's classically called a platform. So I'm hesitant to, completely apply it to nonfiction across the board, including frightening some nonfiction writers who think, wow, I think I have a terrific book on such and such, but I don't have this platform.
Right.
I don't think it's a problem outside of the more functional.
Yeah, maybe platform is more applicable to, say, you know, how to self-help, again, business.
I think it is, Barbara.
Instead of narrative nonfiction like John.
I think it is, absolutely. Even though the narrative nonfiction people may end up like John, called upon, you know, to do some speaking. But I don't think it's a must as part of their background, as credits to get published.
Yeah. What about changes in publishing? A couple of months ago, a friend of mine who's a bookseller at a major bookstore in L.A. was just so depressed about flat book sales and she was saying nothing's selling. And, you know, I don't know. I don't keep my finger on the pulse of book sales, so I don't know if it's always like that, if it's never like that, and suddenly the bottom's falling out. But you know, what's happening with publishing? Is that so? Are we going through a tough time here?
We're going through a tough time, I would say, no more than other segments of the economy. And by the way, our reckoning is that these tough times are strictly a function of the general economy and have nothing in particular to do with books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unfortunately, as much as all of us working with books, for the most part, love what we do and love what it is we try to give to the world, we do have to face the fact that they may be staples to us, but they're not quite bread and milk.
Right.
And so in bad times, some of the book money goes for bread and milk and other essentials. I think apparently some of the booksellers got quite specific about this vis-a-vis the new Harry Potter, that apparently perhaps even trackable with data. In other years, when the new Harry Potter came out, it isn't just that many, many, many stores did well when that book was published. They could chart the success of their overall business from people coming in for the new Harry Potter and sticking around to browse and buying other books.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that was a big hope, not just on the new Harry Potter, but it was also a big particular hope on Hillary Clinton's book. And apparently from the Borders and Barnes & Noble charting, let alone the independents, oh yes, people came in for those two books without question, and as all the publicity shows accurately, but they didn't stick around and browse because they didn't have the income to stick around and browse and buy those other books that lifted all boats, you know,
yes,
in other years. It didn't happen this time.
Hmm.
So that was one of the hopes for this year. And so things have been a little tough, and I think only are going to really get much better when the economy gets better. I mean, I think we're limping along, and I'm very grateful for, I mean, even Elise's novel that I mentioned did quite well for a first novel, and of course, John's book is number three on the Times bestseller list Sunday.
Yes.
But overall, I think I can sense that it's more effort to place a new book. Standards are more exacting, and that goes back to fiction, as you were asking me about before, that tough literate fiction category. So I think a lot of it is just the economy.
Hmm.
Nothing particular to do with books.
Do you see trends? Are things selling now, or are topics or types of books selling more now than perhaps they were? Or does it just depend? Has it always just depended on the project?
Well, to me, there's two different answers. There's observations of the public happenings, which I'm happy to do, and then there's individual feelings about such things. As to the latter, I must say that, and I answer this way at writers' conferences, I don't think writers should pay attention to trends. I think writers should pay attention to what they want to do, because I think if they write a good book of whatever kind, I don't care if it's in what other people might consider a crowded field of literature, if it is a fine book, it will make its way. So I would like to send out that, if I have one message to give in this program, writers should not worry, occupy their minds with trends.
Mm-hmm.
They should just write what they love to write and
yes.
then hope for the best.
Mm.
Now, having said that about private reckonings. In public, I would say the overall trends of readers have not changed a great deal, except that since, you know, 2 years ago today, there is a greater consciousness of, I would say, world events overall, and certainly that part of the world, as reflected in new books every season, lots of which go to the bestseller list, to do with Afghanistan and the Middle East and Al-Qaeda and so forth. I mean, I think that's unquestionably the largest new area
mm-hmm.
of nameable interest. Everything else is, you know, I laugh at a conference if someone says something like, you know, I hear the mystery is coming back or something. And I think, really? I mean, I had it gone away?
You know,
I don't think there are too many nameable categories that have gone away. I mean, I guess formally to cite one trend, and I think this spins off from 9/11/01 as well, there is heightened success with political publishing. I think that was always true, particularly on the right before 9/11. Now, since 9/11, it seems to be even more so true of the right, and now true of starting to be true on the left as well. People seem to be reading political books more. For example, both Crown Publishers and Viking have set up publishing arms. I think they've even given them names, imprint names. Those happen to be on the right, because a lot of the right publishing was taken by Regnery, a little Chicago publisher, and other small houses. And I think a couple of the big houses said, hey, wait a minute, why should we let these little publishers make all this money publishing on the right when we have all the abilities to do it from New York with, you know, much more money than some small publishers.
Yeah.
But I think it's true on the left, too. I have the bestseller list next to me, which I wanted to have for this talk in case. There's a new book by Jim Hightower, certainly on the left, that's new on the bestseller list as of last Sunday. And there is a book by Joe Connison called Big Lies, all about the right from the left. So there's two books on the left now on the list, right up there with Ms. Coulter's Treason and other such. Note the shudder in my voice, Barbara. Sorry, but I guess I'm leaking my leftward politics. No surprise about most publishing people, I guess.
Well, how does that work in terms of, say, your political views or your belief system? Something comes in the door, you see it as perhaps being very saleable, commercial, whatever kinds of, you know, adjectives you might apply to a project that you think will sell, and yet it goes against your own personal views.
I can't do it.
Can't do it?
I cannot do it. No. I could not. You know, I think people tend to think of agents, as with publishers, as all-purpose, as truly generalists. And it may be close to true with publishing houses, most of them, that you could say, yeah, fair enough. They do cross lots of many, many interests and even all up and down the political spectrum. But I think it's far less true of literary agents because all agents, whether it's an independent such as myself or an agent working for ICM, we're still individuals. And I think our limitations, certainly mine, and I'm absolutely not alone in this, are my personal tastes and my personal passions. I mean, there's no way that I pretend to be an all-purpose literary person.
Mm-hmm.
And as one editor friend of mine, I guess I can name her, I think it's a fun, Sarah Burstell, who runs Metropolitan Books mm-hmm. over at Henry Holt. Sarah says to me at least once a year, as we celebrate the First Amendment and all the wide parameters of publishing and free speech, she says, well, you know, we're in a business where all shades of opinion are welcome, and lots of people now are publishing on the right, but it doesn't mean I have to.
Yes.
And I'm sort of like Sarah.
Hmm.
It's just honestly not my politics. And it isn't just that my passion wouldn't be there, Barbara. I don't think I could serve as the kind of advocate that any book needs.
Sure.
I couldn't give passion to a position that I really don't have passion about.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those limitations. You know, let me just say, there are also, you know, much simpler ones. I don't do science fiction because I have no, that classic phrase, the willing suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't do any categories of fiction unless it's a superb mystery or thriller. I don't do men's adventure. I don't do action adventure. I don't do women's romance. I don't. So we all, no agent is responsible for being every man or everyone. We just do what we can that we're comfortable with and can be passionate about.
Sure. We have a few minutes left. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is New York literary agent John Ware. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Jeff Herman's book, Writers are Literary Agents, Publishers, Editors, whatever. It's mm-hmm. another resource book in publishing that lists
yes.
agents. And I always notice when I look at that, or when I last looked at it, the hobbies part of each agent, you know, more of a personal view into an agent's life.
That's right. Jeff gives space for that very few other directories do provide.
Is that a wonderful thing? I mean, has anybody written to you or queried you and said, you know, I know that you say the blues, and I've written something, a retrospective of the blues from...
Absolutely, and I represented and had published with Norton an absolutely wonderful blues autobiography that won the Deems Taylor Award from ASCAP as the best popular music book of its year because of such a listing.
Interesting. So they saw that it was a hobby of yours or an interest, queried you, and it worked out.
That's my memory of what the writer said to me when he came to me, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of them. I mean, my hobby, you know, I'm a runner, and I love Italy. I've studied Italian. I was a singer. I adore music almost as much as I do books, mostly blues and classical, and have sung both. Some of those don't lend themselves. I mean, for example, I have also sold a wonderful book on the Boston Symphony, but I can't say that I could make a living on music books.
Right.
Nor are there that many. So it depends, I think, on the agent's hobby as to whether it's even usable, applicable. But it is fun to list them. And I certainly do get a lot, Barbara, because I said I was a philosophy major.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should take it out.
Well, that's just so interesting about you that you have a degree in linguistic philosophy. I don't think I know anybody who has that sort of degree. Or background. That's great.
I earned it.
Well, would you say a few words about rejections and how to interpret rejections that come from agents when, you know, you send out your work and you get a form back that says, you know, sorry, you'll be better served by someone else, or maybe you get a little note back on a form letter, or, you know, I think it's like when to give up, when to revise, when to put it back on the shelf for a while.
Well, I think, first of all, before there is a collection of them, if you get some, if you get a few. You have to remember what I realize now, looking back on this hour, I've tried to, or I've mentioned quite a bit, and that's subjectivity. I think a writer, apart from needing in general to develop a little bit of a thick skin once one is sending one's work out, I think there's good reason for it, because think of the amount of things just in this short time, Barbara, that I've referred to that are such a subjective matter of taste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a matter of high quality versus low quality. It's a matter of the preference of the professional reader, the literary agent who's read that query letter. So first of all, I don't think a writer should be disheartened to get some back. Now, if you begin to get quite a collection, and in that collection, even as brief as agents are forced to be by the time strictures of responding to the volume of mail we get, there are some grains of, I think, info that can get through, particularly through a collection of rejections. And I think if a writer begins at some point from that pile to sense a consensus, then I think it's time to pause and say, there may be a message here. I know that's, you know, certainly has happened to me where I make a submission, a multiple submission to publishers, and not that it gets turned down, that happens, but that it gets turned down and you see after a while it's for the same reason. Then I think my client and I have to pause and say, wow, we missed something here.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this. This is 6 people out of 7 who are saying the same thing.
Sure.
And so I think that's the only thing that should not discourage a writer, but have a writer back it up a little bit and say, I better look at this again, whether it's looking at the query letter or the work itself, because obviously I'm getting a similar vibe. And even if you don't, and as I say, I know agents mostly don't have the time to be too detailed when saying no thank you, but if you don't sense it, yeah, I would say if you get the sheer numbers, if you get the 35 agents who say no thank you, even without guidance in the rejection letters, you better have a look,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I picked out the number 35, but at some point, if everybody's saying no, I think it would behoove the writer to have a look.
Sure. Oh, dear, we have a minute left. John, any last words, anything we didn't talk about but should have?
Well, I just think writers should keep the faith. I mean, people do want to read books, as you said, and, you know, the hunger remains out there, and I think there's always room for new talent. And in the face of rejection letters, I think writers should hang in there and just do their work hard and carefully and then go through the pain of this application to us types. But keep the faith. Don't quit. Don't go away. There is room. There are new writers coming into publishing and into print every single year. They are the lifeblood of our continuum.
Hmm. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And if you'd like to receive a weekly email notice of who's going to be on, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net or go to my website, writersonwriting.com.